here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stoned, immaculate.
Hello and welcome. This is the C86 show. I'm David Eastor. As you know, we love a special guest. This week it's going to be the return of the American singer-songwriter. It's Kim Ritchie, who I spoke to find out more about life, love, poetry, and all that other groovy stuff. Has had a huge and varied career in music, and I do believe has got a new album out and some live dates. I'll give you the link to her website in the notes below. But this is the interview, so after several minutes of interest and that slightly casual chat, we get down to that exciting subject that was the early formative years. Kim, it's over to you.
I always loved singing. And I had a great aunt in a really, really small town in southeastern Ohio who owned a record store. And so it was just in the bottom couple rooms of a house, and we could go whenever we visited. She let us pick pretty much as many 45s as we wanted to and take those home. So we never had albums. She never gave us albums. Maybe that's why I think in terms of songs.
Yes.
A lot, but and she did buy me an album once when I was in the hospital. I remember I was in, I think it was in the fourth grade, so maybe I was about 10, and she bought me Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs.
Right, kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I was singing. I sang in church. I sang in choir at school. You know, all of that stuff.
And what were your parents? Were your parents at all musical and had any interest in sort of records?
Well, my father died when I was just 2. So, but I'm told that he played double bass and also sang in a barbershop quartet. And my mom sings, you know, would sing around the house some. She never sang, you know, at church or anything like that. But, no, the records that my mom had, the albums that I remember listening to from her were musicals mostly.
Yes, classic West Side Story.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
All those kind of wonderful. What about Elvis? Did Elvis appear in your life at all?
No, I never got the Elvis thing. I mean, because I remember listening to Hound Dog at my cousin's house one time. He had the 45, and I thought that was pretty cool. But then what I was, you know, when I was growing up, we were kind of had the Elvis at the drive-in, you know, when he was in all those cheesy movies.
Yes, he was in a lot of cheesy movies.
Never quite got it. And then after I was out of university and we're living in Colorado, a bunch of us, they had a documentary, I think, on Elvis, and we went to see it. And I know we were just mostly going to as a lark, you know, to make fun of it. And then after seeing that documentary, I thought, oh, okay, I get it. I really get it, seeing all that old footage of him and everything. And listening about the comeback when he did the TV show with the black leather outfit and all of that. But yeah.
And so were you interested in, or were, what sort of singers did you start to sort of gravitate towards? Were there people like Patsy Cline or, you know?
No, we never listened to country music at all. That wasn't a thing in my family. I remember my cousins who were rodeo kids from Colorado, and they'd come over when we were all little, you know, to stay at my grandma's and visit, and we'd get in big fights because they wanted to put the radio on country, and we're like, no way. And but I listened to, I mean, just everything. You know, that's probably the 45.
Yes.
So I listened to everything. I remember Love and Spoonful, Summer in the City. I could still see that.
Classic.
I remember that. I remember all the Motown stuff.
Yes.
That I had, like Jackson 5 I loved. Just anything. I remember I had a band CD, you know.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so I kind of was all over the shop, and I had a Janis Joplin, so, you know, just I liked all different kinds of music, and I didn't get interested in country music, you know, to kind of look back and you know, kind of check out some of the things that were going on. I think I would prefer kind of classic country rather than pretty much what's going on now, but I just appreciated the songwriting. You know, once I got to looking into it, the songwriting, great. Everybody thinks it's so simple. it's funny. It's like, oh, I could write a country song. It's just simple. And it's like, the simpler the songs are, I mean, it seems to me the harder they are. Those writers were able to distill down in 3 minutes, like an amazing story and character.
Yes, it's all about the editing, isn't it? It's quite tricky. It's kind of, and to make it sort of coherent to some, yeah, for the listener to go latch onto. I suppose, yes, I mean, it's not easy, is it? Crikey. Everyone would do it otherwise. So when you left school, did you say you went to university?
Yeah, I went to Western Kentucky for 2.5 years, and then I graduated. I changed schools and went to Ohio University, and I graduated with a degree in environmental ed.
Right. Blimey. And,
yeah, I was in a band with when I was in Kentucky with Bill Lloyd, who I don't know if you'd heard of Foster and Lloyd, which was Radney Foster and Bill Lloyd. They were a country duo in the 80s, I want to say, late 80s.
Yes.
But that's, you know, that's pretty much how I got to Nashville was, you know, Bill. And then later on when I met Radney, you know, they kept going, come to Nashville.
So so during that kind of the 70s, because this is kind of probably the decade that I became much more aware of music, though I still, I don't know, following whatever was on top, you know, on Top of the Pops or on the radio. So it was kind of a glam period, you know, with all that kind of stuff that we got and a bit of David Bowie. I was a bit too young for the punk movement. And then, you know, there was a lot of the singer-songwriters, that sort of West Coast Californian sound that was kind of happening. And a lot of the kind of classic kind of singer-songwriters, you know, from like Harry Nilsson and people like that. So so during the 70s, you sort of slowly gravitated towards the country scene.
No, not really. I never gravitated towards the country scene or paid much attention to it till I came here, really, in 88. But the thing is, it's like popular music. A lot of that, you know, is a kind of a mashup of country and all different, you know, and rock and folk, like the West Coast scene, like you were talking about. A lot of that, like the Eagles, and then there's the Grateful Dead.
I was going to mention the Grateful Dead. I was thinking, yes, Jerry Garcia and all that kind of, slightly country quality.
Yeah, all of that sort of stuff. But I was mostly into the songwriters, but like Jackson Browne, it's funny, I bet a lot of those people now would be put in the Americana bag. You know, but back in the day, that was popular music. You know, that's what was on the radio.
Yes, dear old Jackson from yes, I know, sort of, yeah, classic. Yes, he would have probably been put in alt country. So
James
then,
Miller, all that kind of sort of stuff.
Yes.
Carl Simon, Carole King.
Oh, beautiful. So then as the 80s progressed, were you sort of doing music kind of just as a sort of a hobby while you're doing sort of work and other bits and pieces?
I was living in, we moved to Colorado I think it was 1980, a bunch of us from school. And, I lived out in Colorado and I worked at nature centers.
Right.
Out there. And then I think it was really early 80s. I came, you know, moved here to Nashville. I only probably stayed here for about a year and I worked at the Bluebird. That's when I, used to cook at the Bluebird. And so I was working at the Bluebird and then my boyfriend who was back in Colorado said, I'm going to Colombia, you know, Bogota in South America. Do you want to come? And I said, okay, let me just get enough money, you know, save to buy a ticket. So then I went down there for a while and then we came back to Colorado and I worked in the Nature Center again. And restaurants. I've done a lot of restaurant work, cooking mostly.
Right.
Yeah.
Tough gig.
Oh, it's great. I love it. That's the thing that's kind of keeping me from losing my mind right now is all the cooking and everything, you know.
Yes.
So then after that, we moved to Bellingham, Washington, and my boyfriend was going to graduate school there. So I was working in a restaurant again, cooking. And then after he was finished, it was my turn to say where we were going next. So I said, well, let's just go to Nashville. And it was, you know, it was pretty much of a lark.
Yeah.
And that was in 88. And I ended up, you know, I'm still here.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Because then, you know, as the sort of the 90s, you know, because I suppose in a way, you know, I've always been more, you know, quite a pop kid. So I was kind of into that indie pop stuff from the 80s. I loved bands like The Smiths and R.E.M. and U2 and all that kind of stuff. And then and I just followed the trend, you know, and there was the dance scene that came along with various bands that kind of put that dance influence, and then we had this Seattle grunge scene, and then after that, you know, things changed again, because every 3 years, you know, there's a new sound and there's a new group of young people who want their own soundtrack. They don't really want the previous people's soundtrack. So then in the early 90s, this is when it all starts to click into place, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think my first record came out in 95.
Yes.
So I was here and I was doing, you know, writing for a publisher in town with the idea. They had the idea that they would, you know, get me a record deal. And I think the first time I got any traction, it was funny because they really liked my songs and my demos. The producers would come and ask for copies of them. This was on cassette tape. They'd ask for copies of them to play in their cars, you know, but nobody, because they really liked the music, but they wouldn't cut any of the songs because it was too different. And so the first time anything started to really happen was I wrote a song called Nobody Wins with Radney Foster and sang on his solo record. So the song went to number one, and then I sang all over the record. So that was when people kind of started noticing I was here.
Yes. So when did you start writing? When did you start thinking, look, forget the cooking, forget the nature, the national parks, I'm going to start writing?
Well, I wrote a bit in college, you know, kind of Joni Mitchell, you know, bad Joni Mitchell-esque girl sitting in her dorm room alone with acoustic guitar.
Classic.
Yeah, and I did some of that. And then I didn't really write at all until I moved here, because my friends were, they weren't musicians. They were outdoor people. So we did a lot of like skiing, cross-country skiing and backpacking and kayaking and stuff like that. So, so I just kind of picked it up back when I was here and started, you know, started writing. Pretty much since I got here, I got signed to a record deal when I was 37. So it was, you know, pretty far on.
Yeah, I know. It's quite an amazing story, isn't it? Because it's not the classic kind of cliche, is it, at all?
No, not really. Aside from the restaurant work.
And national parks. It's you know, it's like, oh, okay. So you obviously, and when you, you know, with your first one, Nobody Wins, did that feel, looking back at it, did you think, oh yeah, actually I'm pretty good at this. This isn't just angsty poetry.
I think you know, there might have been some of that thinking, oh, this is great, you know, but not like, oh, I got this down now, because every time I go to sit down and write a song or to write a song with somebody, it's that same feeling like, oh, will I do I have anything to say? You know, can I write a song? Am I all done writing songs? You know, it's always, until you get going, it's that same feeling for me every time.
It must be frightening. It must be like, oh dear.
Yeah.
Yes. So then you got sort of a sort of record deal, which must have been like a big sort of plus and a sort of feeling of confidence and progress. Because actually every artist I ever spoke to, there's that feeling that you really need to feel like something's happening. Otherwise, you just end up with a lot of, you know, that just playing in front of your friends and family and anybody else you can emotionally blackmail to come and see you live, and you know, everyone's very kind, but you're thinking, this isn't quite happening. But then, you know, in the UK, you know, there were certain DJs that would be quite important to people, and then we had one person called John Peel. So getting a John Peel play would just give everyone that little bit of like, oh, thank God for that, and then a John Peel session and stuff. So when you got the record deal and then you started putting the first album, your first one, Bittersweet, Did that sort of come together quite well?
Well, I loved making that record because I made it with Richard Bennett. He produced Steve Earle's Guitar Town and a bunch of other great records. And he also plays, now he plays guitar with Mark Knopfler when he's on tour. He's an amazing guitar player. And it's funny, when we were trying to, you know, get somebody to sign us to a record deal. You can play out all the time here, because I think I got... Well, the way I reckon I got my deal was I was playing at a club here with two other guys, and I think we were even thinking maybe about being a Grateful Dead cover band. You know, it's something to do. And then we played, and we finished, and I was packing up my stuff on stage, and a guy came up to the stage, and he said, "I really liked your show." And I said, "Thanks," you know, and just kind of kept packing up my stuff. He goes, "No, I think you're really good." And I said, "Well, thanks, I appreciate it." And I started talking to him, and I said, "What's your name?" And he said, "Luke Lewis." I said, "You know, hi, I'm Kim Ritchie." And I said, "What do you do?" And he goes, "Well, I work over at Mercury Records." And I said, "How do you like it over there?" And he said, "Well, I like it pretty good." And so I said, "Okay, well, it's nice to meet you. I got to get my stuff off the stage." So I got my stuff off the stage, and he turned out to be the president of the label. So right. I think that was my favor, not to go all, "Oh, it's, you know, Luke Lewis." But then I went and played him some songs in their office, and for him, and I only played a couple songs, and we just got along really, really well. And he called me back, and, you know, they called me back and said, "You know, we want you to make a record."
Yes.
So that was really great. I always got to make whatever kind of record I wanted to. I was always given plenty of rope, you know, because I working with Richard was such a great way for a first record, because, you know, not everybody has a great time making their records. And I had such a wonderful time with Richard. He's brilliant for one thing, and just and it was just, he's just so chilled, and it was just really cool. It was really exciting to make that first record. We were in this kind of crummy old studio that's not here anymore, but it had one big room and one ISO booth, I think. And We started decorating it, and friends then started bringing over things to decorate it. You know, like the folk art thing was really popular then, and so we had, you know, people bringing in pieces of art that we just stuck up all over the place, and it was really a fantastic experience.
Yes, amazing. And then sometimes the second album can be a bit tricky, because, you know, people have, the first album is kind of a huge amount of kind of accumulation of life and experiences and songs that you've been working with or on for quite a few years that you can think, right, let's put that. And then there's a sort of, oh, that album comes out, there's a lot of promotion, touring, kind of general exhaustion. And then, oh, by the way, can we have another 14 songs or 16 or whatever? And that's sometimes tricky. But in your case, Glimmer is the album that everything, the stars line up, don't they? Because it is just, it still sounds like a masterpiece today.
Bittersweet was the second record I made.
Bittersweet, God, I wished I should be making more attention here, shouldn't I? I jumped there. Sorry about Bittersweet.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah, Bittersweet was the second record, and it was really, really well received. It's like. Bittersweet and Glimmer are seem to be people's two favorite records. Like, there's the Bittersweet people, and then there's the Glimmer people at the shows, you know. And but Bittersweet was fun, you know, fun to make, because, you know, we were just making it. It was the road band that we, you know, had been touring on the first record with, and we played a lot of those new songs live to kind of test them out. And it was kind of like the, you know, just the kids making a record without any adults around. And so that was really, really fun. Bittersweet, I got to have some of my friends come and sing on it. And then Glimmer, I made with Hugh Padgham. And we recorded, that was a really completely different record. Bittersweet was all friends and really laid back and chilled. And Glimmer was more like we tracked in New York and then went to London to do like overdubs and vocals and stuff, but I didn't know any of those guys.
Right, because it's okay. So I have to confess, I'm in the Glimmer clan. Glimmer gang. I am in the Glimmer gang. Yes, I realise when you mentioned the folk art, it was the album, wasn't it? The Bittersweet album, which had that amazing cover. So, but then Glimmer had this incredibly kind of powerful black and white picture, which was it reminded me of a German label who do quite avant-garde classical music, ECM. They always had black and white covers, and this just, I suppose, it, you know, yeah, Bittersweet. you know, I suppose this is what we all have personal taste. I mean, it was like, oh, yeah, this is great. And then Glimmer, something, I think it was Coz. There's several tracks on there which I adore. Okay, I have to confess. Other Side of Town and Hello, Old Friend always kind of have blown my mind. So I have to say those two are the ones that probably got me more than, you know, any other, you know, from on that album. And probably, yeah, they're my the highlights, really. So, yeah, it's interesting then that this was, because it's quite a sonically, it's quite a power, it's quite a lot of punch in this, isn't there? And kind of, I don't know, drama, that's sort of, I don't know if that's the right word, but there's a sort of, it's quite, yeah, it's kind of a mix of kind of quite raw emotion with kind of musically quite sort of, quite tense at times.
Yeah, it was. I had a nice time making that too. It was really scary at first. I remember going to. I was staying with a friend in New York in her apartment, and I remember, you know, on the sofa bed, laying there at night, going, "Oh my God, what have I done?" And just thinking, "This is not working out at all." I mean, we took like maybe 2 or 3 days just getting drum sounds.
Right.
So we're paying for this studio and all the really super high-end, you know, musicians, they're just sitting around watching TV, and they catered the thing every day, like, you know, this giant tray of like bagels and salmon and all these other kind of things, and nobody's eating it. Finally, I was just like, let's not do that anymore. We don't need that money spent. But you know, the guys were like, they're just all watching TV and not doing anything. And I remember at one point I said, you know, before I got to know, I said, you know, since we're not doing anything, you guys just want to play, you know, sit around and go over some of the songs. And they just looked at me like, no. So it was just like, okay, this is going really well. And so once we kind of got started and got to know each other, you know, it was really fun. Hugh, one thing I loved about Hugh was we were making the record is I play, you know, acoustic guitar, and that's pretty much it. But I hear all these other musical parts, and so I'd be sitting in the control room and just kind of humming different parts, like vocal kind of parts. Mm. And Hugh said, well, why don't you go in the vocal booth and put those down so we don't forget them? And so that was, you know, on Glimmer, I got to do all kinds of parts that I love, like different vocal things, treating the vocals as another instrument rather than just singing, you know, parallel harmonies or something with the lead.
Yes. And can you remember writing Hello, The Other Side of Town and Hello, Old Friend? I just wondered how those two tracks came together.
The Other Side of Town I wrote with Randy Scruggs, and we got that chord, that key change in there, because we were working on the song, and then I played, you know, had it at the wrong position on the neck, and it was wrong key, and he's like, wait, that's good, you know. So we went on with that, and that song, it's funny, that song was pretty much, that wasn't a great time for me, really, the Glimmer time in town here. And you know, like, it, people read a lot of stuff into songs and everything, but that song was pretty true. It's like, you know, I did find another coffee shop where I could go, where I wouldn't run into all the other people, you know, that I didn't want to run into.
Yes. And,
kind of sort of thing. And then Hello, Old Friend, I wrote that by myself, and I don't know. I remember I was really excited about that song. People seemed to really like that when we were playing it. Like, we started playing it long before the record.
Right.
You know, played it live and stuff. And I was surprised by that, but people seemed to really relate to that.
Yes, interesting. And when you, because you sort of reissued, well, not reissued it, you re-recorded it as an anniversary release last year, didn't you, for the 20th anniversary. I remember Joni Mitchell.
With the pandemic.
Pardon?
I said in conjunction with the pandemic, which wasn't that great for the record, actually.
No, crikey. Not cool. But did that feel strange revisiting those songs again?
No, it was fun. It was fun to redo those songs again, because they were, I think this time we were trying to let the songs kind of speak for themselves a little bit more instead of about the production of the song so much.
Yes. But I don't know if you came across it when Joni Mitchell God, I was going to say years, but these decades, when she re-recorded a lot of her material, and I think she did it in London, and it was slightly orchestral, but it was much more low key, and it's much more melancholic and depressing, which I personally love. So it kind of those sort of songs, which were sounded a bit more chirpy, even though lyrically they were still quite a bit depressing, suddenly sounded really sort of thoughtful and reflective. And I just wondered, you know, especially material like Other Side of Town and Hello, Old Friend. Doing them again, but without that kind of sort of not bombastic, but kind of bigger production, doing it more acoustically and unplugged. I just wondered if it kind of had a bit more resonance when you did it, you know, again for that anniversary.
I don't know if I'd say it had more resonance or anything. I think the songs hold up, and I was pretty happy about that. And I really enjoyed doing a couple of the songs very differently than were on the record. Like, we had Flugelhorn on a couple songs that I just loved having that on there on the record. So it was nice to get to, you know, do those like that.
Yes, yeah, it's quite interesting. Because I know David Bowie, who I sort of kind of love. I remember he did some 80s albums, Tonight and Never Let Me Down. And they had that real 80s sound, which was I found a bit off-putting. But then later on, it's been sort of remixed again, but taken that kind of, you know, that kind of really harsh kind of 80s kind of Dire Straits come, you know, I don't know, Trevor Horn production sound that we had in the UK, uh-huh. Duran Duran and people like that. Dire Straits, yeah. And it sounded quite differently, and it actually is like, oh yes, I quite like this a bit more now. He kind of dated it very quickly, that kind of production sound. So it's kind of, I always really, as a fan, enjoy listening to how people sometimes do a track again, but without the big production and the sort of panic, really.
Yeah, I don't listen to my own records, and I remember walking into a record store one time and they were playing Glimmer, you know, in the store. And I remember thinking, that is a beautiful sounding record. Hugh really did a great job. Just the sound of it is amazing. Because we don't take the time to do that anymore, because there's not the budget. You know, everything's kind of fast and it's all, you know, digitally recorded and all this kind of stuff. I just think that record just was really, really sounded great.
Yes. And did you have a bit of, was there a bit of pressure? Because at that time, I seem to remember, there was quite a lot of kind of country-esque artists that were coming out and we getting quite a bit, you know, a lot more exposure. So there wasn't that sort of the country twang that I grew up with in the 60s and 70s, but sort of the sort of more singer-songwriter with a bit of a country element. Did you feel a bit of pressure from the record company to be the next big thing? Because there's people like, I don't know, Sean Colvin, and there was Shania Twain and Darl Williams and Annie DeFranco and just a lot of kind of people coming through at that stage. I just wondered if with Glimmer, whether they were looking at something that was just kind of like, right, this is going to be the big one.
I don't know. They spent a lot of money on that record for sure. And they didn't want me to do, because I talked at one point about having Steve Earle and Ray Kennedy, you know, produce. There were some people that were trying to talk me into that. And the record label was like, you know, you've done that record. You know, you need to do something else. They weren't very helpful with trying to, you know, with direction. Because I remember probably the only way I got Hugh Padgham to work with me was, I love that he had, you know, done Split Ends and also the Police records I thought were beautiful. But he has the same manager, it turned out, as Richard Bennett, and the fellow was living here in Nashville.
Right.
So that's really how I got connected with you. And it was one of the girls who was a publicist at Mercury at the time who was helping me, not anybody with A&R or anything like that. It was just, and my publisher helped me a lot too.
Yes, interesting. And then you have a sort of the next album, Rides, and this is on a different label as well, isn't it, I believe?
Well, it's the same label. It's the same people, basically, because it was still, you know, that's when Universal took over and Lost Highway was just another, you know, bit of Mercury Records.
Right. So there you go. It's another one.
So Yeah, same people, really.
So after sort of our great experience with the millennium and a new decade, how did you sort of tackle Rise? Was that sort of, did you have a plan, or did that just, right, I got to get in the studio and do another record?
I worked with a couple different people. I worked with, just to see what, you know, what we were going to do. I worked with Martin Tarefe. Went to London and produced a few tracks with him. And then they sent me out to California to do a few tracks with Bill, a track with Bill, and do some writing. And that didn't work out so great at first either. It was just like, I don't know. They were, I just thought they were weird. Cause I remember I went to stay with them and we ended up at this kind of hippie festival sleeping in a teepee. And I was going, I'm not sure if this is my scene or not. And well, we wrote a song, and then when I got back, you know, it was obvious that you know, and Bill mixed the song, and it was really great, and you know, the label was really excited to have me work with Bill Bottrell. And once I got out there and got to know those people, I loved making that record. It was so much fun because I stayed at Bill's. I decided on that record I was just going to do a lot of the stuff that I would never normally do. You know, like they said, well, you know, we'd like you to stay at the house with us. And they had this old schoolhouse. It was really cool in Mendocino that they'd converted, you know, to a house. And had a gym where they put on shows and stuff. And it was really great. So I thought, okay, normally I would never do that. I would stay in a hotel somewhere on my own, but I'm just going to do it. And just, you know, kind of said yes to everything. And we wrote a lot of the songs, maybe about half of the songs we wrote in the studio as a band. And that was great for me because then it wasn't just me sitting around with somebody with a guitar.
Yes.
You know, it was a lot, you know, we'd have the, you know, Brian playing drums and, you know, and a lot of times I didn't play. So I was just free to kind of make up melodies and stuff and lyrics and. So that was really, really great. I love that record. It's one of my favorite records. But it didn't get for some reason, it didn't get a shot at all. Mercury or Lost Highway dropped me just maybe a couple weeks after the record came out. So I never did know what that was all about because the record was doing really good at the time.
Oh, yeah.
So that was a shame because I just think that record didn't get a chance.
Yeah, God, I know. So many people have had sort of moments where it's just like, oh, right, okay. They don't want me anymore. It's over.
Some people have made records and they were never released. They just got strung along forever. That's really horrible.
Yes, it's very, yeah, I know. I, as a fan, I've never realised the kind of ups and downs and murkiness that happens. Did you, I mean, looking back a bit, you know, without the rose-tinted sunglasses, are you amazed about the amount of the money that sort of record companies invested in that sort of period? Because obviously...
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. And also, especially the label that I was on, because they had Shania Twain and Billy Ray Cyrus. So there was, you know, money all over the place. They spent a lot, you know, the label spent a lot of money on records. I remember they took us, like, all the employees, and then I was friends with Luke, got to be friends with Luke, so we always got to go, our band and then a couple other bands, and they would go down to the Keys like for a week, and then we would play for the record label, and all the drinks and all the food and all whatever, you know, spa type things. It was just like, I'm pretty happy that I was around during that, you know, and just working in those studios, because we did overdubs in the townhouse, you know, that's not there anymore.
Wow, that's amazing. I know, it's like I think everyone, you know, who's still in music, who's been through those patent periods, kind of feel like that will never happen again.
Yeah, probably not, because anybody, you know, anybody can make a record now in their bedroom or whatever, you know, so.
Yes, it's a tricky one. There was an interesting documentary a couple of weeks ago on television about this studio in... It was England. No, it was in Wales. You know, Rockland Studios, which was a kind of residential studio. Did you find having a place where, instead of just going off to a hotel or back to your house, being in the studio, almost kind of within the studio itself, did that kind of focus the mind and the kind of the creative process?
Well, I never stayed at the studio. Like when we were in London, I stayed in a hotel. I can't remember what the name of it. It's over in Shepherd's Bush. And I stayed at a hotel over there behind, like, the movie theater and stuff there. And then after a while, it just, that whole record, I just kept going, are you really spending this much money on me to stay in a hotel? This seems crazy. and so then they found there was a studio, and I can't think of the name of it, but it was over, like, around Portobello Road, and they had an apartment that went with the studio, and we rented that apartment, which was kind of made more sense. But no, I never stayed in the studio housing anywhere. Like Bill's place, like, we didn't record at the schoolhouse. We recorded down the way at a barn that right. he had the studio.
Nice, nice. But then you come back to the UK and London and on Chinese Boxes and work with Giles Martin, which must have been quite a surreal experience, realizing the kind of the whole connection with the Beatles.
Well, Giles is a good friend. So I knew Giles long before that. And I knew Giles around the time I was making Rise.
Right.
Because he had he'd come to Nashville with someone he was working with, and they put me together with them to do some songwriting. And Giles and I got to be friends then. And so, you know, I would go over and stay with him, and when I was over in London, and got to be good friends with all of his friends. I remember the first time I got to meet his father, and we were at Giles's apartment, and he wasn't there, and when his girlfriend was there, and me and my other friend, another guy, George Martin came to the door, you know, and the friend of ours said, you know, can you let him in? You know, Giles' dad. And we're like, and I looked at my friend, and I said, do not say Beatles. Do not say Beatles. And so he came in and sat across from us, and we talked about the weather a little bit, and he got tired of waiting on Giles and left. But that was the first time that I got to meet him. And then he's just such a lovely man. And he and Giles they're like two peas in a pod. They're both so charming and funny and really gracious. And we got to go down. I'm glad I got to know both of them. But we would go down to there's a cottage down where Giles's parents had a house. And we'd go down there sometimes on the weekend. But I'm really happy to know those people.
Yes, well, absolutely. It's always a kind of a pleasure, actually, or treat. But I suppose, I mean, during that time, were you looking back or reflecting, did you sort of see yourself as a sort of, you know, the creative process changing from, you know, the years, the albums, the different experiences, you know, because sometimes, again, you know, some people that I spoke to, they start to either develop or they sort of get a bit of loss of confidence. I just wondered how you were kind of navigating, because a lot of people and a lot of bands, I've realised, they have a bit of a 5-year narrative, you know, where they, you know, they play music most of their childhood and that's fine. And then not really expecting to sort of make it to the next level, but, you know, dreaming. And it's, oh, my God, it's happening. You know, things are moving, you know, suddenly without them being able to sort of have any moment to think about it. It's like, right, we've got to get the single, got to do a bit of a tour, got to meet this person. Right, got the album, do a bit more of a tour, then the next album. And it's all a bit of a rush. And then by 5 years, I've sort of noticed this, a lot of bands are really like, OK, we're just about to blow up and split here, and a lot of the people just need a break. So I just wondered how you were sort of coping, because you'd obviously been in music then by, you know, quite a few years.
Well, I was writing all the time whenever I was home, because I really enjoy writing and writing with other people. It's been really hard trying to write songs during this period, this lockdown thing. You know, there's just too much stuff in my head. It's hard to be creative. Some people are being really creative. It's not quite working out for me that way, but whenever I would come home off the road, I would always, you know, write songs, because that's what I love to do. So I have tons of tons of back catalog. And I never had any shortage of songs. The thing that's different now is just like what we were talking about, you know, those first few albums, when you just had all the time in the world in the studio, and everything's just so super speedy.
Yes, I know. It's,
yeah, really like working that way, but that's the way now.
Yeah. I mean, because when you did Thorn in My Heart, that seemed to be another one of those moments where things sort of came together again. Well, this is on another record label, wasn't it?
That was a different record label, yeah.
And was that process, did you sort of have a bit of a, did the stars align for that? Because, you know, the record sales seemed to go up on that one.
Well, it was, people didn't like, some of the people didn't like Chinese Box because they thought it was too pop. And I liked it. I thought that was a fun record. But Chinese Thorn in My Heart, that was kind of more like Bittersweet. You know, we were just all in the studio playing together, and a couple of those guys, like the producer, and then a couple of people that played on the record were in my, you know, touring band too. Yes. So it was kind of more along the lines of Bittersweet, that record was.
Yes. And your relationship, are you still with Yep Rock Records?
Uh-huh, yeah.
So with them, because I noticed with a lot of people, there's often, you know, like they sign to a label and they think, oh, this is great. And then quite a few of the personnel change. And you think, oh, no, I didn't need that. I wanted us to, you know, so that's sort of been quite a sort of stable relationship.
Yeah, they're really small. It's a really small, you know, indie label. And they're good folks. So, yeah, I think so that I've made three records for them, two or three.
Yes, there was, yeah. Thorn in My Heart and Edgeland as well, actually, which was before your the songs of Glimmer. That was the last album you did with them.
Yeah.
So then, because I did it, there was an artist in this country called Hank Wangford, and he'd just been recording a new album, and it just came out at the sort of lockdown, and so right. You know, he feels very sort of flummoxed by it, and I asked him, you know, having this spare or free time, how it was kind of affecting his creativity, and he said it's not good, it's kind of gone. And you sort of also said that it's not been an easy time as well.
Yeah, it's kind of hard. You just feel really up in the air. Like I've started writing now with other people. You know, people wanted you to write on Zoom, and that's horrible. That's really bad. I tried it one time for my publisher, but I don't really like doing that at all. So since we're, you know, have a little bit more knowledge of the pandemic and the coronavirus, I have a friend that I write with a lot, and we sit outside under my carport far away from each other. So we can actually, you know, be outside, and it's hot here, so we have to bring the fan outside. I've been doing some writing with Ben Glover. I've been doing some writing with him, a few people.
Yes.
So that's good.
I think a lot of people are just hoping to get through this year and then some sort of touring for next year. I mean, that would be an ideal thing. Not great, but, you know, it would be better than... Yes, I think everyone's just got their fingers crossed that, you know, next year is going to just feel a bit little bit easier and emotionally a bit sort of looser. And I guess that's what's sort of holding us all together at the moment.
Uh-huh, yeah,
Which is quite interesting. I mean, just as a curious, I mean, if you were to, you know, if you could have said something to your 18-year-old self, kind of starting out in the world of music and songwriting and performing, I mean, what sort of advice have you got, or would you... Have you picked up, you know, wisdom that you've picked up over the decades that you thought, actually, that's one thing that I really wished I'd known when I was 18?
Oh, well, you know, I didn't do any music until, you know, I just kind of played around with it. I didn't really take it seriously.
Yes.
And that's fine. I'm glad that I did all those other things. Like, you know, I lived in different countries, you know, traveled a lot. Met a lot of people that were different from me, which is always a great thing. And so I'm pretty happy with that. I don't think I would like change any of that.
Yes. And would you, I mean, have you managed to, because one thing that often catches people out is kind of not understanding the kind of the business side and the publishing and ownership of music. Did you manage to sort of navigate that with any success, or, you know, so like, you know, I would have done that differently?
No, I'm not good at that stuff. It actually, I even had a business manager that ran off with a bunch of my money. He did that to a lot of people in town. I'm a pretty trusting soul, which probably doesn't serve me well.
Yes, I know. But luckily, you've got this new album out, so obviously that's quite a nice feeling, even though it's kind of not great timing. So if we can plan anything, what's your sort of next move for 2021?
Well, we're just, trying to schedule shows and all that. My poor booking agent has scheduled shows like 2 and 3 times now. And I just got an email. I'm going to be doing some shows with Gretchen Peters in June. So looking forward to that and crossing my fingers for that. Mostly just touring and getting back out on the road. And I would like to maybe start working on another record and something like that.
Yes.
So I might be putting out an EP on a label different than Yep Rock that I did with two Danish musicians. So that's the exciting thing right now, because it's really different from it's not Americana at all. It's kind of Hannah Schneider over in Copenhagen. She did a lot of the production and everything, and it's got strings on it and a lot of keyboard sounds, and it sounds pretty modern. But then we did the like kind of old thing where we doubled the vocals, like she and I, we sang the part together. So I'm pretty happy with that. So I think that's going to be coming out sometime in the future.
Yes. And have you managed, because fans are fickle people sometimes, aren't they? Have they stuck with you most of the time, or have you got quite a different audience than you did in the early years?
No, they're pretty good. They're still around. I mean, there's people. I keep in touch pretty good on Facebook and that kind of sort of stuff. But there are definitely people that were there that are still there, and they were there from the get-go.
Excellent.
So, yeah, it's kind of nice.
That's good. I know, because sometimes people, it's always nice to get new followers, because you did quite a sort of an intense little tour at the end of last year, didn't you? You came to the UK, I believe.
Yeah, I did. Well, I think I was with Gretchen doing some shows, and then I did a few shows on my own too. I think that was last year. Might have been the year before.
Yeah, so I was just having a look.
To blur in together. That's the thing with now. Like, it's hard. I had to actually look on my calendar to figure out what day it was last week sometime. You know how you might go, is it Wednesday or Tuesday? But then this was like, I have no idea. I'm gonna really have to look this up.
Yes, I know. I'm always 2 weeks behind, actually. I always think, oh, yes, it's the middle of the month. And it's like, no, it's the end of the month. And, I'm always like 2 weeks, like, oh, yeah, it's easily done. But look, Kim, thank you ever so much for giving me the time for this. This has been amazing. And when I put it out, I can always send you a link, and you can always post it on your Facebook page. And that would be fantastic. But thank you ever so much again for the interview. And much appreciated. And thanks again for the amazing music over the decades.
Oh, thank you. It was nice speaking with you, David.
Okay, then. Take care.
You too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was me in conversation with Kim Ritchie to find out more about her life in music. She also has a new album that's out, which is titled Every New Beginning, and live dates throughout March, which we've had, May and also June. So the May dates are in the UK, so do check them out. Anyway, this has been the C86 Show, David East. So if you want to contact me, you can on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, just do C86 Show. And all these interviews have been archived on Spotify, iTunes, Podbean. Have a great week. Stay safe.